Carter.
I'm Eloi.
And I'm Erin.
And if you don't know three black bitches who love true crime, you do now. This is the I Ain't a Killer podcast.
Hey y'all.
Hey.
Hello. This week on I Ain't a Killer podcast. Need to work on that accent. I ain't been in a while. So when I pop up in the UK, they think I'm British. Good luck with that.
Right. I'm like,
that's a little far-fetched.
I don't know.
I'll try though. My friend did it. We was at work one day and she did it. She was playing around. It sounded bad to me, but somebody from some Brixton or Worcestershire or wherever the fuck.
Not Worcestershire.
Was like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, oh!
Damn.
She can get away with it. So can I. But yeah, welcome to another week of I Ain't a Killer.
Yes.
I'll be sticking with us week to week. That's so cool.
And you know, I noticed, maybe this is an off-the-air conversation, but I noticed our newer episodes are getting more listens.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like,
I haven't checked.
Our newest episode has more listens than, like, 10 episodes back.
That's dope.
Yeah. Which to me means that, like, new people are listening. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We need the girls.
Hey, y'all. Right. Oh, okay.
We keep breaking
a little sultry.
Like, oh, man. Remember when we wanted, like, I think it was, like,
100.
We just wanted 50 listens on, like,
yeah,
the first day.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, shit. We keep blowing past these goals. I'm like, oh, fuck. This nigga's listening to us for real.
I know.
But, yeah.
All right, so we told y'all we were going to start doing the updates that we mentioned. And so we're going to finally update y'all. Not finally. We talked about this 2 episodes ago, I think. So this is about Lindsay Clancy. And she is the mother who was accused of killing her 3 children. While she was on a lot of drugs, she was clearly in distress.
Prescribed drugs.
Prescribed drugs, yes. So this is a little update that came out on February 25th, and the article is in the U.S. Sun. So the title is Disturbing Words Lindsay Clancy Left Chilling Note About, quote, resenting and struggling with children before strangling her 3 kids.
Mm-hmm.
So Lindsay Clancy, age 32, has been charged with 2 counts of murder.
32? She's
young. Yeah, she's young as hell. She's been charged with 2 counts of murder, 3 counts of strangulation, and 3 counts of assault with a deadly weapon. On January 24th, her husband, Patrick Clancy, discovered his wife injured in the backyard after an attempt to end her life. He then went down to the basement where he found Cora, age 5, Dawson, age 3, and 7-month-old Kaylin, who had been strangled with exercise bands. Jesus, I forgot how, like, tragic this story is.
Yeah.
Ooh, should have did content warnings, but we'll put them in the description. So Patrick had been out picking up medicine and takeout for dinner when the incident occurred. Clancy has been struggling with postpartum depression for months, which saw her on 12 different medications.
Still, them doctors got to be held accountable.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody has to be held accountable for that.
Yeah, that's so wild to me. So the mother from Duxbury, Massachusetts, admitted herself to McLean Hospital in Belmont on New Year's Day after she had thoughts of harming the children and suicidal ideations. Prosecutors found a concerning note in her phone where she usually details her mental state, medication, and daily tasks. The note said, quote, I think I sort of resent my other children because they prevent me from treating Cal like my first baby. So Cal is the youngest one.
Mm.
She continues, and I know that's not fair to them. I know that. Quote, I was feeling so depressed last evening when Cora and Dawson came home from school. I know it runs off on them, so we had a pretty rough evening. I want to feel love and connection with all of my kids. Clancy was discharged from the psychiatric hospital on January 5th. Clancy appeared for her arraignment in Plymouth District Court via Zoom from her hospital bed. She is being treated for spinal injuries that have left her paralyzed from the waist down. Clancy's attorney told the court that his client is still suicidal, saying, quote, she's extremely emotional. However, she's unable and has been unable to express any happiness or sadness or cry. The defense has pleaded not guilty on her behalf, and colleagues of the midwife submitted letters describing their shock at the incident. Nurse Erica, who worked with Clancy at Massachusetts General Hospital, wrote, "I do not know a better mother than Lindsay Clancy. She lives and breathes for her children." Another former co-worker of Clancy, Margaret Hemp, said that the midwife would check a baby monitor to check on her children while she was working the night shift. "I can remember a time prior to Lindsay and Pat getting married that Lindsay would say she wanted to have a baseball team of children," she wrote. A friend of Clancy's added, "Her first priority was always for her children to feel loved, safe, and happy, and I trusted her implicitly with the care of my own children over the past 3.5 years. A number of mothers also wrote letters about the challenges of motherhood and postpartum depression. They outlined the pain, inward battles, and the darkness of being a mother with postpartum depression. They wrote, "As mothers, we are asked to hold the weight of the world on our shoulders. We push through the pain and smile despite our inward battles. Many of us have felt the darkness of postpartum depression, and for that reason, we are able to sympathize with Lindsay's pain." However, prosecuting attorneys claimed that Clancy acted relatively normal that day, saying she played in the snow with her kids and chatted with her husband about dinner. Speaking exclusively to the U.S. Sun, criminal defense attorney Duncan Levin clarified that according to Massachusetts state law, the burden of proof lies within the state. This means that prosecutors will have to point to evidence that could prove Clancy was of sound mind when she allegedly killed her children, rather than the defense being pre-assured to prove she was suffering from psychosis. That's
I feel like there's way too much proof to show that she had to have been going through some kind of psychotic episode, right?
I mean, just based on the medications alone, yeah. Outside of her mental state, like, there's no way she was, like, acting, like, she was able to act.
This is a situation where, like, I forgot that, like, I not forgot, but, like, it just, I guess, kind of blew my mind for a second that you have to go through the judicial process for this. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Does that make sense? Like, I'm not saying that, like, people shouldn't be held accountable, but, like, this is clearly a situation where a woman was outside of her entire fucking mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, nothing about this is normal.
Yeah.
Like, not even relatively.
Yeah.
Like, she belongs in a hospital, mm-hmm. like, for a good long time, because there's something clearly very wrong. Also, putting any individual on 12 medications will drive them somewhere other than sane. Mm-hmm. Like,
I think we talked about this last time. I can't imagine it as anything other than your brain swimming in medication.
Literally.
That's so much for your body. And I forgot what I was going to say. I agree with everything that you said. Like, if there's ever a time for us to consider abolition, it would be times like this. Because not only was she having a mental break, her character doesn't point to like any signs that she would do anything like this.
Right.
Yeah.
So just the testimony of her character alone is like, okay, so what led from that to this? There's obviously some, you know, huge gap between the two.
Right.
And she's paralyzed from the neck down. So what does carceral punishment look like when someone is a quadriplegic?
And what purpose does it serve here?
Yeah.
Especially when like from all of the people closest to her, clearly her children were the most important people to her. Mm-hmm. And I know that she did the act, so it's kind of hard to, like, logically understand it. Mm-hmm. But I think her children not being there is more than enough punishment for her.
Right.
And I don't know. I just feel like this is way more nuanced than what
the judicial system
is going to allow for. Yeah. I mean, she even, like, admitted herself to the hospital before this incident occurred because she had thoughts of harming her children. Like, clearly she was scared and she didn't want to do it, or else she wouldn't have tried to seek help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the fact that she was, I don't know what happened at that hospital, but she wasn't, like, cured of her whatever situation she was going through.
Or the reason she really needed.
At all. Because, I mean, this happened.
Yeah. And a lot of insurance don't even cover, like, mental health. And
listen, some niggas don't even be believing in postpartum depression.
That's so wild to me, because it's good.
Yeah.
I'm like, and that's because people don't care to learn and do research on things that wouldn't impact them. But the amount of change that a body goes through when it's pregnant and having a child, like, as soon as you give birth, your hormone levels, like, drop.
Yeah.
Like, literally that immediate. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how people couldn't understand that would lead to, like, chemical changes in the brain.
Yeah, most definitely. And I feel like a lot of people don't want to know. Like, when it comes to mental health, when it comes to women's health, when it comes to mothers, like, when it comes to people who give birth, nobody gives a shit what happens. They care about the babies. And
supposedly. You know, until the baby's born.
Until the babies are born, right. But nobody gives a fuck about the entire process of what it takes for a person to give birth to a baby. And like, what happens to... There's a person on TikTok. I think they did an article about her now. I think it's like Unique Thoughts or something like that. She has this list. And every time somebody lists like all the different changes that happen or like the reasons not to have a child or whatever, it like you can see it like screen recording and go into her notes, and then she'll go all the way down to number like 238. Yeah. It's like, do not have a baby. Your teeth can fall out.
That freaked me out when I learned that.
Yeah. And so honest conversations about mental health and honest conversations about how different things affect your mental health is something that we desperately need, but we can't even get there because we barely even have a support system. So what the fuck do we do, like, modifying our justice system? Like, it's weird.
I just learned that postpartum doulas exist.
Yeah,
last year
I just learned it
too. And people but the thing is, like, I know, like, people deserve to have a living wage, but they're expensive. Like, it's expensive to have a doula, a midwife,
a night nurse,
actually give birth to a child. Mm-hmm. Do you know what a hospital bill looks like for giving birth to a baby? Like, and then to have a postpartum doula after the fact, like, that's a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody wants to come play with a baby. Don't everybody want to come clean up and cook and prep meals and, like, you know, all that shit that you really need after the fact for, I mean, really, people need that for months after they give birth.
Mm-hmm. I was on TikTok and there was this parent that had just given birth and they were like, everybody comes over wanting to see the baby and they walk in the door and they're like, oh, what does the baby need? What does the baby need? And the parent's like, I haven't gone to the bathroom in 5 hours.
Right.
Yeah. I haven't eaten in 2 days. Yeah. I haven't slept in weeks. And like your first thought, and I get it, is like, what does the baby need? But it's like, once you have a child, you no longer are a person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the time where you need the most support.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't know.
Horrifying.
It is. It's sad.
That's what I'm saying. Like, anybody in community, now that I'm older, if I was 20, I wouldn't be saying this. But now that I'm older and I spent time, you know, with my nephew when he was like a baby, and now that I spent time with him when he was older and stuff like that, I'm like, for community, I feel like that's a good role for me. Mm-hmm. Like, to step in and be like, you need a week off or something like that, or do you just need a weekend or something like that, or do you need to take a nap? Do you need somebody to come clean up? Do you need somebody to cook for you? Stuff like that, because that goes so far and affects people's mental health with or without postpartum depression. So, so to think about, like, this whole conversation that we're having, and then, like, you know, for people like her, it doesn't even, these thoughts don't even occur to, like, our systems and shit like that.
This is the last thing I'm gonna say, but I feel like also the more kids you have, the less people are showing up to, like, support you after the fact. Mm-hmm. This is our third baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like people are probably like, oh, you got it, like, you're mommy, you're super mommy, and like, probably weren't coming to, like, support. I'm sure people weren't stopping by as often. Her mother-in-law probably didn't stay for a couple weeks or anything like that. And I can't imagine having three babies, and then her husband probably was still working just as much. I mean, because you gotta pay
bills. I
simply cannot imagine.
Yeah, because people want to watch the cute little new baby that doesn't move around. They don't want to watch the 5-year-old, which is the one that needs to be watched while the parent is taking care of the little newborn.
Uh-huh.
And I think that stuff like that probably contributed to, like, her thought process, because on her notes she said she's not able to be a mom to the baby like she was to the first one. Mm-hmm. And that's because she's raising three kids while trying to be like a mom to the newborn, and there's no way you can give as much attention.
Mm-hmm.
So some shit's gotta change.
I just feel terrible for her, and I honestly just hope they don't lock her up. Like, I hope they find something else. Like, she needs rehabilitation. She needs help. She needs to be in a facility where she can actually get for real help. But even those facilities are absolute trash. So it's like, what do you do? It's terrible.
Well, keep her name on the list.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there'll be updates so we can do it in a later episode. Yeah. All right. We'll be back with the main story.
All right, we're back. I'm the lead investigator this week. I'm Bailey Carter. And
You always say that.
Well, I don't know if they know my voice.
Yeah, because I'm serious.
I actually really want to know. Can y'all tell the difference between our voices?
Yeah. Between Eliwa and Carter's voices. I feel all like mine is. Really?
I want to know.
Okay.
Because our Siri's pick up on each other all the time.
They do. Because my Siri answers Eliwa.
Are you? Oh, you all did tell me that. That is so strange to me.
But I do want to know. Let us know.
We should do a test. Like, who's talking right now?
But they be saying, like, Eliwa's funny as fuck. Blah, blah, blah. They said blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, they know who's saying. But it also might be, like, our personalities. Like, they get us enough to be like, oh, that was definitely some shit Eliwa would say. Oh. I don't know.
That is a thing. Anyway, it's me, Carter. Hello. Hi. How are you? Content warnings for this episode are sexual assault, rape, and graphic description of a murder scene. And the story is Angela Simoda. Does that name ring any bells?
No.
So this one's kind of short too, but it is interesting.
I feel like we always say that.
And then it'd be long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like your episode was like an hour.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. Yeah. In the notes, it looks really short.
Yeah. So Angela Simoda, who was called Angie by her friends, was born September 19th in 1984. So she was a Virgo. Actually, no, she was not born in 1984. She was born in 1964. I think I took this note wrong. But she's a Virgo. She was born in Alameda, California. And her parents were Frank and Ruth Simoda. I couldn't find a whole lot about her childhood, but she was, you know, like the standard intro to a true crime story, like, she was really friendly. She was smart. She was like, she lit up the room. But like, it seemed to actually be true for her. Like every anecdote that I read about her, like she was just like, I don't know, super friendly, like a girl's girl. Like she didn't meet any strangers. Like really, really like an attractive personality, which probably led to what ended up happening.
I'm interested in is that why killers target
those kinds of people?
Those kinds of women. Yeah. It's always like her smile lit up the room.
I feel like that's one of those tropes where it's like the popular girl or the kind popular girl is always a victim because like
they could never get them and they're jealous of them or something. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I feel like in some stories that happens.
When she got older, she ended up attending Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. And she was also, like I said, a really intelligent person. She majored in computer science and electrical engineering. And I'm not going to hold y'all. There's like 40 different kinds of engineers, and I don't know what none of them do.
Not a damn one.
Like,
listen.
I don't even understand what engineering is. What do you mean? Like, period.
I think I know what an engine is.
I think it's like building, like making things. I don't.
But electrical engineer? What do you... anyway.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
It's smart people shit. She seemed to be, like, a really focused student and did really well in school, and she was super well liked by her peers. She is the victim of the story. So at the time of her murder, her best friend was also her roommate, and her name was Sheila Wysocki. Wysocki? Because I said Wysocki? When Angela and Sheila met, they weren't super close in the beginning. First and foremost, because when they first met, Angela had a boyfriend that Sheila did not like. Fair. He apparently was like just a shitty guy, and he had a bad attitude. And at one point, when they broke up, he became verbally violent and like threatened Sheila with a knife. I mean, threatened Angie with a knife, and like tried to destroy herself, like cut up her clothes and shit like that. Well, they're in college, so I'm assuming he had to come to their dorm room to do this. So he's acting an ass in the dorm. Sheila was also a little bit more conservative or maybe like introverted, so she wasn't super social. She didn't drink or party a whole lot like other college students do. Like, she didn't drink at all, actually. And oftentimes when they would like go out, she would stay at home. But eventually every time they grew close and they had a really close friendship, that would ultimately last the rest of Angie's life. So we fast forward to the night of the murder. So October 12th in 1984, Angie was 20 years old, and one day they decide to go out to the state fair in Texas, her and two friends from school. So they went to the state fair, they had a great time, they decided they didn't want the night to end, so they go bar hopping afterwards. So Angie's out with two of her friends, their names are Russell Buchanan, who's a guy, and Anita Kadala, who's a girl. So they went to a couple different restaurants in like downtown Dallas or whatever. And then they went to a couple bars, and they eventually went to a bar that had like this like exclusive club upstairs called the Rio Room. So I guess it was like a private club that Angie was able to get them into because like she knew pretty much everyone who was in the bar. So she's like bouncing around, socializing, just, you know, again, someone who never met a stranger and like got along really well with everyone. So they got access to this club that was called the Rio Room. So they go upstairs and they hang out, they dance, they have some more drinks, but they don't stay out super, super late. Around like midnight, closer to 1 a.m., they decide to go ahead and call it a night and go home.
All right, y'all, we'll be right back after we pay some bills.
Are you a huge cunt?
Us too.
Wait, can we even say cunt?
Of course. It's empowering these days. Cunt, 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 cunt. I'm Ange Balasone, a.k.a. the drag queen, Fat Girl Gina.
And I'm Mike Fails, just a normal gay guy, I guess?
And we're the hosts of The Big Cunty Couch,
a gorgeous new talk show podcast where we invite queers and peers to sit bitch and be fierce on a huge-ass couch
while we gab about all things gay.
So come get cozy
and cunty
with us. We're pan for platforms, so find us anywhere online and get listening, sweetie.
Or watching.
Or both.
Otherwise, why the hell am I in full drag?
And we'll see you on The Big Oh, wait, I thought we were going to say that together.
No. On The Big Cunty Couch. Mwah.
So Angie was the one who was driving that evening, and she gave her friends a ride home. And they lived super close to like where they were hanging out. And Angie also lived in that area, but Angie also drove 30 minutes out of her way to go visit her boyfriend, whose name is Ben. And she just wanted to tell him good night.
Is this the same boyfriend?
Yeah, I'm hoping
this is a new guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is her current boyfriend. So the other guy's an ex now.
Okay.
Yeah. So she goes to visit Ben. She's like, I just want to tell you good night. Like, he had been invited to go out with them that evening, but he didn't come because he works construction, and so he had to be out really early in the morning.
Responsible.
Like, right?
That's really sweet.
It's also really cute that she was like, I just want to tell you good night in person, mm-hmm. like, give you a little kiss, and like, go home. And drove 30 minutes out of her way to
right,
do it.
Right, because I wouldn't be doing
that's
that.
So right. I would do it.
Maybe I'm just a little jaded right now.
That's fair. So after visiting with Ben, Angie went straight home to her apartment. And then around 1:45 in the morning, Ben gets a call from Angie. And Ben's waking up at 1:45 in the morning like, what the fuck's going on? Like, he's confused. He's a little disoriented. So he says that Angie was speaking to him like they had already been in a conversation. Like, she just starts talking, but he's like confused and he's like, what's going on? And so then she says that a guy knocked on her door and asked to use the bathroom and use the phone.
What?
So I read/heard two different accounts of the story. So one version of the story goes that Angie said that this guy knocked on the door and she told him no and didn't open the door and got like spooked and called Ben because she just thought that him hearing her on the phone would like scare him off and deter him,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But another version of the story that I read is that she lets him in to use the bathroom and use the phone. But she got on the phone with Ben just like as a precaution because the guy was making her nervous. So in that version of the story, it said that she told Ben that she had let the guy in and that he heard the guy or heard some sounds in the background. And then Angie said, I'm going to call you back. And then the phone just cuts off. So Ben was like, that was weird as fuck. I'm worried about my girlfriend. So he calls her right back, but she doesn't answer. So he calls her over and over and over again. She still doesn't answer. He's like, all right, this is fucking weird. I'm gonna get in my car. I'm gonna go check on her.
See, he's doing all the right things.
Right? So he gets in his truck to go check on her. Again, it's a 30-minute drive. And cell phones weren't super popular. It's 1984. But because he worked in construction, and I'm assuming he was like, maybe he had his own company or he was in a leadership role or something like that, he had a car phone in his truck.
Mm. So car phones. Do y'all know those, youngins?
Right.
Back in the day.
Literally put car phones in the console
yes,
of cars.
There was a and phone right there, like the kind that are on your wall with the cord in your car.
They don't even know what that is, right?
Oh my God. Y'all just do some research.
They do
we don't have the time.
To imitate phones.
Right.
They put a flat hand.
Yes, I saw that. Like a child did that.
Yes. And I'm like, oh,
how do you talk on the phone?
We're old.
Oh, that's scary. My kids can all, my future kids can only have flip phones. I'm gonna keep them grounded. Keep them
Motorola. I'm right. A brick.
Right.
You're gonna play Snake, nigga.
Right. Black and white.
Just like the rest of us.
Right.
You don't even have a backlight on that
thing. Right. You can only text us when the sun is up.
We were so excited when phones had flashlights.
Right. Flashlights.
Anyway.
But yeah, so he has a car phone, so he's calling her the whole time he's driving over there. And she's still not answering. Still not answering, still not answering. So he finally pulls up to the apartment. He runs up to her apartment, knocks on the door, no answer. And then he's banging on the door, no answer. At this point, he is like incredibly worried, freaked out. He runs back down to his truck and he calls the police. Also, this was a little bit of an interesting piece of information. 911 wasn't popularized until like late 60s through the 70s.
Wow.
And so like it wasn't like a like everywhere people just automatically call 911 in an emergency. He had to call information to get the number for the police department and call the police directly. Yeah.
Wow. I never learned about that ever before.
Yeah. I had to Google it because I was like, there's no way. Like, they had to have, and it was available, but like, I think it was started by AT&T to use as like a national emergency line. And then like, it like, wasn't in every like small city and everything until like the late 80s.
Wow. That's so interesting.
Yeah. So he called the police and they pulled up pretty quickly. So they arrived at 217. Remember, like, they left the bar initially like after midnight, closer to one. So all of this happens pretty quickly. So they arrive at 217. They come up to the door. They bang on the door. They don't get an answer either. So they get the building manager to give them the keys to Angie's apartment and they let themselves in. So trigger warning. This is when they discover what's happened to Angie. So they come into the apartment and Angela's body is laid out on the bed. Her eyes are wide open. She's been killed. She's nude and she has been visibly sexually assaulted and stabbed. So they also said, this part was so intense, that she had been stabbed in the chest so violently that it looked like her heart was sitting on top of her chest. Yeah. So a really, really, really violent scene. So they begin their investigation right away, I'm sure after a little bit of shock, and they collect blood and semen samples from the scene. But as you know, I'm sure, Eloi, DNA matching was still like in its infancy because it was like the 80s. It's 84. So the medical examiner's office concluded that Angie had been stabbed 18 times.
What?
That sounds very personal.
Yeah. Is this somebody she knew? Because people don't just go stabbing strangers 18 times. Well, maybe they do. But.
Well, I mean, that's what the police, I'm sure, thought, because they put together a list of suspects pretty quickly. I'm sure y'all can guess the list of suspects.
Her boyfriend. Ex-boyfriend.
And Russell Buchanan.
Yeah, the friend.
Yeah. Mm. So, Ben, because you always got to check the boyfriend, the husband, whatever. Russell, because not only had he been out with Angie that weekend, he also only lived 5 minutes away from her. And then Eric, the ex-boyfriend, because he had been violent with her before. So, they begin questioning them, getting as much information as they can on them and all that, right? Even though DNA matching wasn't a thing at the time, they did run the semen sample to see if they could determine a blood type from it, which I didn't even know that was something that you could do.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. In doing this, they found that whoever had killed Angie had what's called, I don't know if it's a condition or like, it's called a non-secretor, which is a really gross way to say something, but it basically means that the person's blood type can't be typed from their semen. And supposedly only about 20% of people who produce semen are non-secretors.
I've heard that term before, and I didn't really know what it meant, but I think it was in like the true crime context.
Yeah.
Does that mean they don't secrete sperm? Or don't
so they produce sperm, but you can't type their blood from their sperm sample.
Oh.
So like, I guess normally, well, not normally, but 80% of the time, roughly, when you have a sperm sample, you can tell their blood type from their sperm somehow.
Oh.
But there's 20% of the people in the world who make sperm who you can't do that with. And you don't like fluctuate back and forth. It's like, if you are a secretor, you're always a secretor. Like every sample you create, they'll be able to get your blood type from.
Okay. I would have called that like a non-typer or something.
Yeah,
like
the secretor, that feels weird. Yeah. I'm not liking it.
Maybe it's because like maybe your blood doesn't secrete into your sperm. I don't know. It's still gross. I don't like it.
I don't like it.
But that's the last time we have to use that word for right now.
Thank you.
Actually, no. Oh. I lied. Anyway, fortunately for Ben and Eric, they were both found to be secretors. And so they were pretty much cleared from suspicion. Like I said, you don't go back and forth between being a one and not being one. Russell, however, is in that 20%.
It was him.
Yeah. So the police were like, you did it. Like,
right.
You live 5 minutes away. You were out with her this evening, and you don't secrete. And that's like, what are the odds?
Yeah.
So when the police went to question Russell initially, news had already broken about Andy's murder. So like, you know, it had already been on the news, I'm sure in the paper or whatever. But Russell was like, I didn't even know she was dead. So according to Russell, right after they had left the bar, and after Andy had dropped him off, he immediately went to sleep because he had to be up the next morning to travel for a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the wedding, he came back home and he had some work to take care of. I think he had like an internship or something like that. So like immediately was in the books or at work or whatever, doing research, whatever the fuck he was
doing. Probably also important to say that at that time, people weren't all over social media didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like people had access to information.
Didn't
like
have smartphones. Yeah. Didn't have a cell phone at all.
So you probably could just be alone and not know what's going on in the world easily.
Easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he was cooperative with the investigation. He went downtown with them. He answered their questions. He didn't like retain counsel or anything like that. He took a polygraph test, which he was initially told that he had passed. But the police were like, everything still points to you. So we're still going to look into you.
Yeah.
And they also had no other leads, like at all. But they didn't have any like material evidence to connect him to the murder. So they had to let him go. But even after they let him go, they put him under surveillance,
mm-hmm.
which is a smart thing to do. So over the next 6 months, though, they would, like, just randomly call him in for questions. They'd be like, okay, you got to come downtown, mm-hmm. and we need to ask you some follow-up questions. And he would go. But his story stayed the same the whole time. And throughout these 6 months, the cops, I guess they got frustrated, and they, like, became more aggressive with their tactics. So they then started telling him, oh, actually, you know, like your polygraph results were inconclusive and like, you know, something's not right. Things aren't adding up.
Y'all trying to trap niggas at this point.
And they even at one point during one of his interviews pulled out, like didn't warn him at all, but they pulled out crime scene photos of Andy and like just put them on the table, like in front of him.
Did they stop looking for anyone else? They were just like, oh, it's gotta
it
be him.
It seems that way.
Interesting.
It seems that way.
Yeah. It's also hella convenient that he lives 5 minutes away.
It is.
And that he would do some shit like this and then also leave DNA.
And then dip the very next
right, time. And then leave town.
That's wild.
So the cops start doing all this, and Russell's parents, because mind you, he's still a college student.
Yeah.
He's fairly young. His parents are like, nah, you need to get a lawyer. Like, they dragging it.
Yeah.
Because it was clear that they just were gonna keep at it until they could, if not find evidence, create evidence.
Right.
And that's what his parents were worried about. So while this is going on, Russell is also accepted into grad school in London.
Convenient.
You know, some might say that. So the cops are like, well, fuck, like we don't have any reason to keep him here, but if he goes to London, that's obviously very bad.
Yeah. And it's a wrap. Like,
like he's in the wind.
He has access to hundreds of other countries at the point.
Yeah, he could get on a train and just be anywhere.
Yeah.
So in a last ditch effort, y'all remember Sheila?
Yeah.
The police reached out to Sheila, Angie's best friend, to ask her if she'd be willing to help them with their investigation. So they told Sheila, they're like, look, He failed his polygraph test. We feel like he lying. He intentionally went out of town after the murder happened. It's very sketch. That's what they told her. So she was like, well, yeah, of course. This is my best friend. Like, I'll do whatever y'all need me to do. So they asked her to wear a wire and go to dinner with Russell and try to get him to say something incriminating, basically. And, you know, she was under the impression that she's going to dinner with a whole ass murderer. So
yeah, that's terrifying.
Right? I'm just like, I would obviously do anything. Not just for my best friend, for anybody I considered a friend. So I would probably do it, but I would be fucking shit. Like,
you're shaking my boots.
I'm not even gonna.
Are y'all gonna give me a
pistol? I wouldn't do that shit. I'm sorry.
Like, y'all are right outside.
Y'all have the. So
the cops are outside watching.
I mean, yeah, but like, I see it's too many shows where bitches get killed under police watch.
True.
One.
It's true.
And then two, so y'all have all the resources literally in the world. Y'all have access to Interpol. Y'all have access to national databases. Y'all have, I don't know, K-9. No, drone technology, whatever the fuck. Wait, it's 1984. Never mind. Shit,
not drone
technology. Let me back it up. Whatever is like the thing that you could have access to, y'all have access to it. Because if y'all wanted to call the FBI in, y'all literally could. I don't know. It's just too much. I feel like for a young woman to be like the game changer for y'all. Like, right. You know what I mean? I feel like they just be using
y'all
people.
Need Sheila.
Yeah, they just be using people. And then, like, if they get hurt, oh well, she does. Like, that's just me. I don't trust it. I'm sorry.
It is. I think the other thing to keep in mind, though, to your point, like, the degree of violence of this murder would have had me terrified.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, stabbing somebody's heart outside of their chest is absolutely, like, what? Mm-hmm. No, I'm not going anywhere with anybody that I think might have actually done that. So, yeah. Actually, you're right.
Yeah.
But she did. She did do it.
She bold.
Right.
So, Sheila said that Angie's murder was the most traumatic thing that had ever happened to her, understandably, because they were also roommates, so that means that she lived there as well.
Yeah.
But when this happened, she had been away at her mom's house, and she just simply did not go back to school, which I completely understand.
So, whoever did that, she was probably watching, too, to, like, see if Sheila, like, will go somewhere and not be at the house.
Right.
So, once Sheila went to dinner with Russell, he told the same story. I mean, they didn't get any new information out of that tactic or whatever. And so there was nothing the cops could do to stop him from going to London. So he went to London.
Wow.
Yeah. And he studied architecture, which he ended up actually doing really, really well in. And Angie's case went cold after that.
Damn.
And it stayed cold for 2 decades.
Oh!
20 years.
Yeah. I feel like they didn't even try.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like,
I mean, they still had Russell Buchanan listed as their only suspect, but there was literally nothing that they could do on that front. And then they had no other leads. And it doesn't seem like they investigated or searched for any other leads.
But the DNA.
Is Russell a white person?
Yeah. All these people are white.
Yeah, Buchanan gave me a white vibe.
Oh, I forgot that was his last name. So I'm like, Russell?
Russell. Jackson?
Washington?
So, in 2004, Sheila says that she had a vision of Angie standing at the foot of her bed, and she said she knew she had to do something.
Oh, my God.
So, at this point, Sheila reaches out to the police department in Dallas, even though she lives in Tennessee at this time. She's married at this point. She's got 2 kids. She's then lived a whole separate life. But now she's like, this is heavy on my heart. Angie visited me, told me I got to do this. Also, Sheila at this point is still very much under the impression that Russell is like, she's like, I gotta get him. Like, he can't be out here living this beautiful life, having a successful architectural career. Like, this man is being like Architectural Digest and shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he raped and murdered my friend. Like,
right.
Absolutely not. So she calls the police department, and she was told that the case is cold and they don't plan to reopen it. There's no reason to reopen it, whatever. They give her the runaround, but she was like, I wasn't going to give up. So she called the police department 700 times in that year.
Oh. That's a lot. That's like twice a day.
Yeah. And she also got like other people from like their sorority and stuff to call up there too. And while in between these phone calls, I don't know when she had time with 2 kids and a husband and calling 700 times, but she started doing research on her own too. So she's like, She said that she had a quote unquote war room. So she took the study in their house and just basically made it like her research room. Mm-hmm. Like, wow. I guess she had newspaper clippings and like
all like, the strings and stuff.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
She was a little unsure.
Yeah. She's like, nah, if y'all not gonna do it, I'm gonna do it. But I'm gonna still harass y'all because you should be doing it. So she like made the case her life at this point. And while she's like putting all this stuff together, her husband like kind of like flippantly like told her she would make a great private investigator, and she was like, you know what, why the fuck not? So she went and got her private investigator's license.
I like hey. Sheila.
She about the action,
right?
Yeah. And so like while she's trying to get the police department to reopen Angie's case, she started taking on small cases like in addition to investigating Angie's case. And from some of the articles I read, I feel like they were trying to shade Sheila low-key, like the police department, because they made it seem like she was trying to claim that she got the case reopened like single-handedly, and they're like, they did it of their own volition. I don't believe they did it of their own volition.
I don't, because if she got to call y'all 700
times,
no. Yeah. They hate being upstaged.
Right.
They hate being fucking embarrassed. Right. And take credit for shit that people be doing.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a random bitch on fucking Facebook that'd be solving murders and shit.
Right.
And y'all could have used y'all's resources to find this shit, so now you got it.
And mind you, it's 2004. Like, DNA technology has been available at mm-hmm. this point. Like, y'all absolutely could have answered that woman's first phone call and just simply ran shit.
Right.
It happened in 1984.
Yeah, but when was that? I think I remember you doing the case where he was like the first person convicted off of DNA.
Oh,
like
yeah. That. I think that was like the early 90s. Right? Yeah.
So definitely. It didn't even have to be 2 decades.
Y'all didn't. Really it really didn't.
Yeah.
And they also, at one point, I read in one article, they supposedly told her that the DNA samples had been lost.
How y'all lose evidence when it's sitting in a box in a fucking warehouse?
They said it was a flood, but
it's always a flood. It's always a fire.
Right. But at the same in the same year, mysteriously, a cold case unit was established in Dallas, and Angie's case was reopened, and the DNA samples were found.
Liars.
Yeah.
Because they want to walk back there.
Embarrassing.
How embarrassing.
Y'all are embarrassing. So they finally ran the samples. So this is 4 years after Sheila's vision of Andy. So February 14, 2008, Linda Crum is the lead investigator of this cold case unit, I suppose. And she ran those DNA samples and got a hit for a profile of an unknown male. This is just based on the DNA samples that they had in their own like mm-hmm. local system.
Yeah.
So they took that profile and ran it through the CODIS, which is the national what is it?
National
DNA.
National database. That's the word I was looking for. And on March 19th of 2008, they got a hit, and the profile matched a man by the name of Donald Bess, who was already in prison serving a life sentence for sexual assault.
Not Russell?
Not Russell.
Damn.
Wow.
Right? I was shook.
That makes me feel bad for Russell.
Yeah, no.
They absolutely like harassed that man.
It probably ruined his life. Like, I'm sure his name is everywhere.
Well, we'll get to that.
Oh.
So the police, of course, set up an interview with Donald, who was already in prison. So they had to go through like, you know, those channels to sit down with him. And when they did sit down with him, Donald was like, I never hurt anybody. Sir, you're literally in prison.
Right. For hurting right somebody.
Now. So like, he acknowledged that he like, I guess, had sexual contact with those people, but he said he never hurt the victims.
What?
But then he also shut down the interview after he asked them if this was because of what had happened in Dallas. And I guess they were like, yeah. And he was like, okay, I'm done talking to y'all.
Wait, so he knew what they were talking about?
So I think what happened is that, like, I think he put two and two together because he's already been convicted of this other thing and then like some other stuff that had happened. So let me, okay, back to this. So when police start digging into Donald, they find out that he was in Dallas in 1984 after having just been released on parole in March of that year.
What?
So he was released from parole because previously he had been convicted of aggravated sexual assault and aggravated kidnapping in 1978. Which he had originally been sentenced 25 years for until he was paroled in 1984.
So how many years did he serve?
That is a good question, because I'm no scientist, and I can't do that.
Oh, oh, that's okay. It wasn't the 25. 25
years, it definitely wasn't the 25.
25 yeah. years minus him being white. Right.
1984
yeah. minus 1978. He served 6 years. Oh, 6 years of a 25-year sentence. So, yeah. He was supposed to serve 25 years, and the literal year that he was paroled is when what happened to Angie happened to Angie. And then the very next year after Angie's murder, so 1985, Donald ended up being arrested, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison for the aggravated rape, aggravated kidnapping, and sexual assault of another woman.
What does aggravated mean? I mean, I know what it means, but what does it mean in the context?
Yeah. Do y'all know? I feel like it speaks to the level of violence. That's what I've always assumed. Okay.
Because in my mind, I'm thinking like somebody who like causes other types of physical harm in the process of trying to sexually assault you. Like maybe they pulled a knife on this person, or like pistol with them, or choked them out, or tried to do some other shit in addition to trying to sexually assault them. That's what just, you know.
What makes, yeah.
So in the context of aggravated assault, it means an assault with the intent to murder, rape, or rob the person. So yeah, I guess when you do something with another intention as well, another harmful intention.
Okay.
So yeah. So back to what you said, I think that like because he had already been convicted of the other things, and this was like one of the, I guess, maybe bigger things, because he had been convicted of like rape and assault, but not murder. So like I think maybe that has always been in the back of his mind, like I'm gonna one day have to like answer for this or something.
Okay.
Like that. So Donald Best was born on September 1st in 1948. So he's also a Virgo, which I thought was interesting. For no other reason than it's just a coincidence that stood out. He was born in Jefferson County, Arkansas, and Donald was one of four. But him and his brother and his other siblings were raised by a stay-at-home mother who Gary, which is his brother's name, described as manipulative and an alcoholic. Their father was a traveling salesman, which that's one of those things that never seemed real to me, but I guess it is.
Maybe it was like real in the 60s or
when like Pursuit of Happiness.
Yeah.
When Will Smith was doing.
It also gives second family. It gives second family.
It does. That's immediately what I thought. I was like, that man had a whole other family. But apparently in the times that he was home, he like punished Donald more than the rest of the kids. So like supposedly like even when the other kids did things that weren't necessarily Donald's fault, he would get in trouble for him. So there's that. But Gary, his brother, his younger brother, testified at Donald's trial and sentencing for the case for Angie's murder. And he said that he and his brother had always been close, and even described him as his protector. And he begged the court to spare his brother's life. I'm so sorry. If I had been in that courtroom as Angie's loved one, hearing of like what happened to her, I would absolutely have to beat his ass. Because what do you mean?
Yeah, well, no, who would I fight in?
Because I don't give a fuck about none of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I don't know. That's like a weird thing for me. Like, you know that your protector, your brother, has done these things.
Mm-hmm. Not just what we're here for today, but also
other things. And you really think it's okay to say, I don't get it.
Like, just sit there and shut up.
Yeah.
Why are you even here, to be honest? But yeah. So Donald was convicted for Angie's rape and murder, and during sentencing,
you got it, friend.
Several other women came forward testifying that they had also been raped by Donald.
Oh, wow.
And one of these women was his ex-wife.
What?
Who said that he had abused her and their child during their marriage. They didn't say what type of abuse towards the child. I'm hoping nothing too extreme. It's awful regardless, but yeah. And then on June 8th of 2010, Donald, who was now 62 or 63 years old, was sentenced to death. So, you know, anytime someone's sentenced to death, they get appeals. So he filed an appeal, and on March 6th of 2013, it was rejected. And then August 13th in 2013, a certiorari petition was filed. I don't know, some kind of petition was filed. It don't really matter because it was denied. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals refused an appeal that he submitted in addition to those other ones. And they upheld the findings of the Dallas County Trial Court. Donald remained on death row until he died last year in October, on October 8th.
Wow. Just the other day.
Yeah, literally just the other day. Yeah. But back to Sheila and Russell. So Sheila still lives in Tennessee. She's still a private investigator. She actually does really well.
My girl.
Yeah. She's got a website. She's got a podcast. I think she's written books. She's been featured in People, Good Morning America. Damn. All that shit. So, yeah, she found her calling through this horrible, horrible thing that happened to her friend, and is still helping families, like, solve cases that the police won't take seriously. Russell also had a great life. He ended up getting married. He had an incredibly successful architectural career, and he harbors somehow no resentment to the police department. They even did issue an apology to him, and he said it wasn't necessary, which I thought was crazy.
But it's because he's white.
Yeah. But he and Sheila at one point, like, not confessing, but they were both interviewed for a documentary, and they were in the same area, and she, like, came to him and told him, like, you know, you don't know this, but I've spent the last however many years of my life trying to convict you, and I just want you to know that, like, I'm sorry. And he was like, you just were doing what you thought was best for your friend, and he seemed to be, like, really understanding. So Russell seems like a decent guy. Like, you know, I'm glad he's not a murderer and a rapist.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
Wow. The bar's in hell. But,
yeah, at this point.
Yeah. But he's also, from what I read, doing great. Still rolling in dough, making amazing houses for people.
Yeah, I'm architect speak.
Yeah. Thank he's you. Got his own firm and all that. Like, he's a big fucking deal. So, yeah, that is... the story of the murder of Angela Samada. I don't know what happened to Ben, but oh, this is a random sad speculation. But during the investigation, the police speculated that it was possible, based on the timeline, that when Ben got to Angie's place, that, like, she was actively being murdered when he was trying to get into the apartment.
Oh, oh no.
But that wasn't confirmed, but that's just, like, a speculation.
I hope he never knows that.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
No. Yeah, that is something that they speculated.
And then I'm like, well, if she was, then where did Donald go? Like,
right.
How did he get out?
I mean, I'm assuming because it was an apartment building, maybe he, like, snuck out the back. I don't know. They also speculated that he had, like, followed her throughout that evening when they were bar hopping. So, like, he saw her in a restaurant or something and, like, became fixated on her and followed her to her home after the fact, which is horrifying.
These just made me never want to
That makes
nowhere.
Me so scared.
Yeah.
Those things weren't ever, like, necessarily proven or confirmed, but that they felt like they had enough information to speculate that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, shout out to Sheila.
Yeah.
This is a fucking real one.
She was like,
she made a real friend,
and y'all not gonna ignore me. She said, I'll be on this phone every fucking day, morning and night. I'll call you at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m.
And all my friends and all their friends.
Right.
I fuck with that. Alright, well, I guess that's the end.
That story, yeah.
We'll be back for Shit to Be a Crime. Should this be a crime? I just got through yawning.
Okay, it's alright.
Yes, it should.
If you want to. I know you just did the story, but
I think it's good.
Okay.
So this article is from the New York Post. And it was published, written, posted, whatever you call it, February 24th of this year. A man ate a rack of ribs next to me on a plane. Wait, it gets worse. Where there's smoke, there's fire. A woman trapped on a crowded plane next to a passenger consuming an entire tray of barbecue took to social media earlier this week to vent her frustration. The sticky situation has ignited yet another debate about airplane etiquette, as travelers struggle to cope in an era when the sky appears to be the limit when it comes to in-flight idiocy. Take it on my nerves.
Yeah, these are supposed to do
right. They be doing
it. Fed up flyer Lana Tallon from Glasgow, Scotland, found herself in the middle of a global food fight after the Twitter user unloaded on her few hundred followers. No chance. Wow, this pop-up ad is really... No chance is the guy next to me eating a full rack of ribs plus sides on this plane, Tallon said.
Plus sides.
Providing photo evidence in a post that has already received 5.5 million views. Commenters immediately began queuing up to dish out platter-sized portions of disapproval. I don't even like using my laptop on the plane in the middle seat, said user Daniel Berman. Based on the non-existent gap between his belly and the tray... Actually, this one's fatphobic. I'm not reading that. People at the airport, we order coffees black and croissants, nothing more. And while Tallon found herself a horde of allies, plenty of digital bystanders disagreed, sometimes strongly, with the unsolicited criticism aimed at an unwitting passenger just trying to eat a meal, with many going so far to cheer him on with cries of love that for him, to I approve, to you're just mad he didn't share. My absolute hero, if you don't respect this power move, it says more about you than him, said Mike Walsh in a stern rebuke to the critics. The growing debate quickly turned to the food itself, a sad-looking takeout box with what appears to be sloppy, sticky-baked ribs with the membranes attached.
They love an extra word.
Yeah,
like the New York
sloppy, sticky.
Right? Like, just say it.
A scattering of french fries and a stub of corn on the cob, slathered in butter and cheese.
Ooh, damn,
that
shit sounds good.
All right. Thanks to some quick sleuthing, the less than Texas worthy meat was revealed to have been procured from an airport restaurant called Frankie and Benny's, the Washington Post reported. The Applebee's-esque chain can be found all across the United Kingdom, offering a menu of American and Italian classics, including the so-called smoky ultimate barbecue ribs, described as a slow-cooked rack of tender pork ribs with barbecue sauce. I don't know why we needed to know all that, but there you
honestly,
go.
Honestly, the next Should This Be a Crime is going to be a New York Post.
No. Crime to be a writer at New York Post.
Yeah, I'm not going to read the rest, but that gives you the gist of it. And before we started recording, I also mentioned that I saw just on Twitter today a picture of someone eating a full crab oil bag on the plane.
I have so many questions. Starting off with, okay, so they were flying out of Scotland or to Scotland?
To Scotland, I believe.
From what, London?
Somewhere in the UK.
Yeah.
So the restaurant is in the terminal. So anything you get... It depends on the airline, mm-hmm. I feel like. Because, like, things you buy in the terminal, sometimes you can take on the plane, but sometimes the airline will be like, nah, you gotta throw that away before you get on the plane.
Yeah, definitely. I would assume that, like, somebody could get a full rack of ribs, fries, and corn on the cob. I heard something about butter and cheese, and I just got hungry as fuck.
Yeah.
I would assume that they would see that and be like, no, girl, you're not bringing that up. Like, maybe some chips, maybe some fruit or something like that, but like, nothing egregious. Like, that, if you was that hungry, you should have ate at the terminal. Like,
but also, I'm like, I don't know, it's hard.
No, I'm just saying,
I pay for my food. I'm gonna eat my food.
I was recently on a flight and I felt bad about eating my Chick-fil-A on the flight. Yeah. And I feel like that's more like fast food for some reason feels more reasonable to eat on a plane. But I even felt bad doing that. And I don't know why I felt bad.
Yeah.
But I guess it's just like what's normal, like what is just like
I think the part that makes it uncomfortable is you sit so closely to people on a plane.
Yeah,
like the space that you have is so small, everyone's gonna smell whatever it is that you're
eating. I think that might also be
like
it.
You sticking your elbows out trying to bring the rack of ribs to your mouth and like that's a lot,
and ribs are so messy, like are you licking your fingers,
right?
Like, what's the situation there? Right.
But also I believe that people deserve to nourish their bodies whenever they want that nourishment with whatever, however they want to nourish it.
But the seafood boil is taking too far.
That is a lot. That is a messy ass meal. Like one little bit of turbulence and I got a fucking crawfish tail in my hair. Yeah.
I barely like eating that on the ground because it's just too messy. Yeah. And it takes so long. Like, you're gonna be cracking crab legs the whole flight.
Yeah.
I think if I personally, like, as a flight attendant or whatever, I could see that being my job to be like, girl, just eat that in the Just keep that there. I think personally, I wouldn't mind if somebody was eating next to me as long as it doesn't get on me. I've seen people eat crap before and then like they're breaking it apart and like doing all the extra shit. Flying all on me and shit. Like, I'm good on that.
But people wear bibs to eat crap.
Literally. That's why I'm like, it is messy.
I think niggas, it was a nigga that did that, right?
That one, yeah. The crab ball was definitely niggas.
Yeah, the crab ball is very niggerish. And they be doing shit like that because I'm niggas. But,
that'd be the thing. I don't be caring about, like, I don't know, being perceived as like respectable. So that piece of it is like, I guess, what's bothering me. Like, I don't want people to not feed themselves because they are worried about being respectable. But also, like, I don't want nobody eating next to me. I'm not gonna hold you. I really don't. I don't like the sound of it. I don't want to smell it. None of that.
I want to hear your
personal preference.
Yeah, that stresses me out.
My personal preference is no. But like, do I think you should have the right to? Yeah. Like, I guess.
I also feel like you can kind of tell if somebody's not dragging it. You can tell if somebody's a little bit like uncomfortable eating around people, but they need to eat or something like that. So I feel like if you taking your time, like I said, like licking your fingers and you got the fucking moist wipes and you got your elbows all on me and shit, I don't want that. But at the same time, like, if you need to eat, just go ahead and eat. Just get that shit over with. Yeah. Especially if this is like a 4+ hour flight. Yeah. Like, you know, that type of shit. But why you would want to eat something so heavy on your stomach during a 4-hour flight that might cause you a little of the bubblies?
Listen, like, a whole rack with cheese and butter on it. Is the bathroom even available? Like,
that's what I'm saying.
That's a choice, like, there.
No, that sounds like liquid coming out of your butt. Like,
yeah.
And no, that does not sound filling at all. Maybe a sandwich and chips.
Yeah.
That's just what I
guess what it comes down to is, like, I don't believe in etiquette, but I do believe in being considerate.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I really hate to hear people eat. And, like, people, like, there are some people who truly, like, make noise when they eat and, like, don't even realize it, but, like, make a lot of noise. And, like, I have fully accepted that I do have misophonia. Like, I think I have, like, a whole sensory disorder. Y'all, just a little bit quick side note. So, I have fully realized that I have a sensory something because I wear ankle socks all the time.
Yeah.
I don't even like to have socks on my feet just because it, like, makes me uncomfortable most of the time. But I was at the gym and I had worn some over the ankle socks and I'm running on the treadmill, right? All of a sudden, I start feeling like my legs are falling asleep. I'm like, I'm having a fucking stroke. I'm gonna fucking die. Like, what the fuck's going on? And I'm like trying to subtly, like, hit my leg, like, not look like I'm going through something. I'm trying to, like, finish my workout.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, I'm wearing, like, over the ankle socks today. I rolled the socks down. I immediately felt better. But I was about to have a full blown panic attack because, like, just having the socks over my ankles while I was running made me feel like my whole body was going numb from the feet up, like, slowly.
I
was like, there's something wrong with me.
No, I feel that. Like, there's some situations, like, back when I was in a relationship and we were, like, at night cuddling. Like, if he was holding me too tight and I felt like I couldn't move, not like he's squeezing me, but, you know, arm over, I would start to feel like I was, like, having a panic attack.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's happening with me? But I don't know, like, maybe it's a sensory thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I say all that to say, though, like, if somebody's eating next to me in a cramped space, like a plane, and they're really loud, it's definitely going to stress me out. Like, it's going to cause me extreme discomfort.
Yeah.
That's why I always eat with like, TV playing, because I don't even like to hear my own, like, crunching
sound. It'll be too much,
Can you hear me? They're like, no, that's inside your mouth, bitch. Like,
right.
So, yeah, no. And so on a plane, I feel like that would make me very self-conscious. And that's why I always try to, like, get there early, make sure my terminal exists.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta
literally
look at it first. You gotta look at it first. Okay, 826, that's real. And I don't know if any of y'all flew in Atlanta, but, like,
you need to be.
Bitch,
sure.
Yeah, you have to be sure because they be switching shit up. And it's the busiest airport in the world. So everybody named Mama, everybody in the world is flying out of Atlanta when you gotta fly out of Atlanta.
And don't have to get on the plane train when that shit done broke down or the escalator not working or they doing construction or whatever.
Because right now the escalator doesn't work in one of the terminals. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, excuse me.
Yeah.
When I had to wait in line to walk up a treadmill that was turned off, bitch, what? carrying Jordan in a carry-on bag, and then my carry-on, and I had to go get my check bag, and then the check bag wasn't at the term, the thing that they said it was supposed to be. Mm-mm. And then they throwing luggage off the thing. People,
I hate it there. Yeah. I hate it there. Why are there two securities, south and north? But south is only for TSA. But depending on who you ask, it might not. I hate it there. That is the show this week. That's the crime. The Atlanta airport.
Oh,
I hate it there.
Yeah. So I feel like when you flying out of Atlanta, or like you're from Atlanta, you flown out of here, you know, like you got to get here at least 2 hours before your flight take off. And mm-hmm. This ain't gonna happen to nobody here, because it's like you're gonna be the earliest fuck. Mm-hmm. You're gonna be sitting at the gate. Like,
you're gonna sit down and have a martini.
Yeah.
You're gonna
sit three down course meal.
You're gonna do it all.
Fall asleep and shit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have to get there that early before your flight. Like, it's not a Richmond small town type situation. But
man, you ain't taking no ribs on the plane.
But yeah. So the ribs, I'm gonna go ahead and say not a crime.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I like ribs. And then too, I just feel like, I mean, hopefully this person was starving and it just needed like a real, I don't know, hearty meal or whatever. But however, the seafood one, that's we need to, as black people, and this is not for our non-black listeners. Just sit out on this one. Just observe from the outside. Niggas need to have our own like nigga policing system where it's like not carceral, but like it's like serious. To be able to give out citations.
Like, don't do this
for doing nigga fuck shit, because
crab legs.
Why are you doing a seafood one in the movies? I've seen the people doing it in the movies. Seafood is fire, but y'all, come on, y'all taking it too far. So it's getting a nigga citation. This is the first one ever issued. I'm pretty sure somebody else has a concept like this. Okay, so that's that. And definitely a crime to be the Atlanta airport.
I think I have to agree with all of that. And as far as the ribs, like, I'm a personally like look at you strange. I'm gonna look at you out the side of my eye.
Yeah,
like, why are you doing that? I mean, I guess you're hungry, but please. To everybody out there, I am 5'4". I wear my hair in a bun. I got some freckles. If you're sitting next to me on a plane, do not eat no damn ribs. Everybody else, you're fine.
Yeah. You know, I prefer that you didn't, but do what you gotta do. My discomfort should not dictate, you know, how you take care of yourself, but...
Yeah, just
don't be aggy. Like,
hurry it up.
Planes are uncomfortable enough.
But you know what we should have talked about? Who was it that posted on Twitter? Oh, it was Crystal. Posted on Twitter that somebody reached over and turned off her air on the airplane. Yeah.
Now, that's absolutely a crime, because I'll bop you upside your fucking head. And don't get me put on no-fly list, because then I really don't have nothing to lose. All I live for is travel. So if I'm already kicked off the plane, bitch, you about to get it.
And bitch, I'm not going to get on Amtrak. The fuck? Why would you do that? That's so anti-black. I'm sorry.
Reaching over and touching anything of mine will absolutely get you fucking slapped. Are you out of your goddamn...
Are you even from this... First of all, are you even from this world to be that rude? And then two, to reach over me and cut off my airman.
That is so wild to me.
I was mad for her. That shit was...
Mm. I just skipped over because I was like, not today. Like, I'm not
you
even...
You can't get mad over that.
If I see a picture of a certain situation, it'll make me think about it and think about how it will play out. Yeah. I can't fight. I'm even shorter than Aaron. So these are two things that would get me bitch the fuck slapped. It's just like, I just don't have those options. But in my mind, I can't fight. I can do anything over here. So I'm like, you know what I mean? I'm thinking about you know, like the hits and the choreography and all this shit. So I was just like, no, I'm not thinking about that, because I will absolutely, if I could fight, I would absolutely beat a bitch. Because you reached over me.
That's when you gotta grab a weapon, Fran, because fuck it. They gotta learn a lesson. Not reaching over me and touching my shit.
Oh,
know?
That's so disrespectful.
It's so disrespectful.
Yeah.
Crime on that one. Yeah. That wasn't even what we were talking about.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, let us know what you think.
Please.
You can find us online at
Ina Killa Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and Ina Killa Pod on Twitter.
And you can listen to us on Spotify. You can listen to us on Apple Music. And now you can listen to us on Pandora and everywhere else. Yeah.
Until next time.
Until next time, Killa Bees.
Bye.
That's how you say bye.